Welcome to Prima's 2023 podcast series. My name is Shonda Ragland. I am the Senior Director of Education and Training at Prima. On this Prima podcast, Gregory Hearing will discuss the COVID-19 pandemic, lessons learned and applied. Gregory is a shareholder at Gray Robinson. We will also be joined by Prima's Education Coordinator, Taekwon Gilbert. Taekwon will moderate the discussion. Enjoy the podcast.
Thank you for joining us today, Matt.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
To start, what are some of the macro impacts that COVID-19 has had on the U.S. workforce?
To answer this question, I kind of want to go over just kind of some statistics that I gathered from some various sources, including the U.S. Department of Labor and some other private research institutes. And basically, we'll talk about unemployment first. So unemployment rose from 2.7% in March 2020 to 13.1% in April 2020. 79.4% of unemployed individuals in April 2020 were furloughed, so there was a temporary layoff. And then unemployment amongst individuals with disabilities was the lowest in 2019 at 7.3% that it had been since 2008. And after the pandemic started, that quickly rose to 18.9% in 2020, nearly 5% higher than individuals without a disability. And then 2020, U.S. healthcare employees experienced a 249% increase in injuries and illnesses. Nearly 50% of hours worked from 2020 to December 2020 were via telework. Telework only represented 5% of hours worked prior to the pandemic, and we're going to talk about here later on why that's so important in this this new wave of telework that sweeps over the country during COVID-19. Pew Research Center conducted a study that found that 60% of teleworking employees felt less connected to coworkers while they were teleworking. And then CNBC also conducted a survey in which 1 in 4 employees said that they plan to quit their jobs once the pandemic ends. 80% of those individuals plan to quit due to advancement concerns, and then 72% were reevaluating their skill set. And then according to a PricewaterhouseCoopers survey, 35% of employees planned on seeking a raise after the pandemic, 25% of public sector employees planned on seeking a raise after the pandemic, 47% of employees prioritized their work location, 65% of workers discussed sensitive political and social issues at work in the last several years. We'll talk about that when we get to the mask mandates here in a little while. 63% of employees who can work remotely prefer a mix of remote versus in-person work. And 26% of employees want full-time remote work now. So these are just kind of some statistics that kind of give you a macro view of the impact that COVID-19 had on U.S. employees. And so some of these issues are going to be important for some of the other discussions that we have today with respect to teleworking and some of the other impacts that the pandemic had on public employers and how, you know, the novel issues that were raised and, you know, what employers can do to move forward going forward to address some of these issues from the pandemic.
What are some of the novel issues raised by the pandemic from a labor and employment law perspective?
So the biggest ones were some of the issues that we first saw, novel issues that were raised from interplay between CDC guidance, OSHA guidance, and EEOC guidance. So really the interplay between the federal guidance that was issued in response to the COVID-19 pandemic and how employers interacted with that guidance. Then we also, some of the other novel issues raised were the vaccine and mask mandates that we saw around the country. Teleworking became a novel issue. You know, a lot of employers had dabbled in some telework before, but this was one of those instances where, you know, this was the first time where employers were almost required to allow telework in order to maintain to efficiency and, you know, basically provide the services, especially for public employers, provide some of the services that they were required to provide when employees couldn't come into the office. And then state and local laws and executive orders and the interplay between those, as well as liability from employers when employees contract COVID-19. So that was a novel issue where employers were very concerned about liability. And not only did they want to keep their employees safe, but they were worried about the liability of COVID outbreaks at work as well. And then public employers had to determine how they were going to address collective bargaining agreements, otherwise known as CBAs, as they're oftentimes referred to during a pandemic. Public employers were certainly faced with major issues, such as whether some of the safety precautions that they were going to implement were subjects of bargaining under the various state organization laws, labor laws. Some of the subjects of bargaining include taking the temperature of employees before they come to work, requesting that employees self-report health-related symptoms, sending employees home who are sick or asking employees who have COVID-19 symptoms to stay home, amending pay, time off, sick pay, and personal leave policies, implementing social distancing measures, implementing telework procedures, changing start times, work shifts, and hours, and revising work assignments to accommodate employee absence or decrease product demand. These are all issues that public employers with CBAs faced, and whether or not they were going to have to bargain over these issues based on the language of their CBA. And if, certain CBAs, if they contain provisions for emergent circumstances, such as special rights for employers to enact measures to respond to a crisis, then some of those employers were a little better off. For the employers that didn't have provisions regarding emergent circumstances in their CBA, many of the topics might have required bargaining. So those are some of the issues, the novel issues that really arise during the pandemic.
How did labor and employment practitioners navigate the interplay between EEO laws and maintaining a safe workplace environment?
So we saw guidance issued at the federal level pretty early in COVID-19 during the pandemic when we first started really going into the pandemic in March of 2020. To kind of give an overview, the real main guidance that all the other federal agencies tended to reference and kind of focus on was the CDC guidance. And so you have to kind of go back to before the COVID-19 pandemic. The CDC was closely monitoring the international spread of COVID-19 in late 2019 and early 2020. And it was on January 22nd, 2020, that the CDC actually confirmed the first case of COVID-19 in the U.S. And then shortly after, on February 25th, 2020, the CDC advised that COVID-19 was heading towards pandemic status. And sure enough, on March 13th, 2020, that's when President Trump declared a national emergency, and we saw the shutdown, occur just a couple days later. The CDC was really quick to follow up with COVID-19-related guidance, which it still periodically updates for employers. And so that really helped. And the CDC's initial guidance included guidance for critical infrastructure employers, such as state and local government employees. And this guidance included return to work procedures tailored to essential workers and their employers, and returning employees to workplace as quickly as possible after COVID-19 infection or exposure. Such procedures included temperature checks, mask mandates, social distancing, and disinfecting. And at the outset of the pandemic, OSHA was quick to remind all private employers of OSHA's general duty clause, which requires private employers to provide a work environment free from recognized hazards that are causing or are likely to cause death or serious physical harm. For instance, OSHA issued its guidance on preparing workplace for COVID-19 on March 9th, 2020, so that was actually before the shutdown. Throughout the pandemic, OSHA provided employers with extensive COVID-19-related guidance, and employers who typically were not impacted by OSHA's industry-specific requirements, such as employers with office environments, were suddenly expected to review guidance related to COVID-19 workplace safety and implement SANE. Now, how does that apply to public employers? Well, 28 states have state OSHA plans which apply to public sector employers. So while federal OSHA doesn't apply to public sector employers, states that have OSHA plans, which there's currently 28 of those OSHA state plans which apply to public sector employers, those public sector employers do have to worry about the state OSHA plans. And the reason why the federal guidance is important is because these state plans must be at least as effective as OSHA in protecting employees. Accordingly, they must typically mirror OSHA requirements and may impose additional requirements as they see fit. And so most guidance, whether federal OSHA guidance, state OSHA plan guidance, or other COVID-19 related safety guidance, reference and closely follow those CDC's guidance. Now, when we get into EEO laws, equal employment opportunity laws, this is where the EEOC kind of came in with their guidance, and they basically took what the CDC and OSHA, both state OSHA and federal OSHA, were saying and said, this is how you can keep your workplace safe while also complying with EEO laws. And this EEOC guidance is really essential. The EEOC responded to the pandemic by issuing guidance to assist employers in navigating the novel EEO-related issues. Public employers and their council relied heavily on this guidance in navigating initial COVID-19 EEO issues. And in fact, you can still find this guidance on the EEO's website. And they've issued other guidance since then, but they keep this guidance updated even today. And so basically what the guidance focused on was mask and COVID-19 vaccine mandates open the door for requests for reasonable accommodations under Title VII in the ADA. And so such mandates also implicated the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act And because vaccines administered prior to May 27, 2021 required pre-vaccination medical screening, which sought information regarding an individual's medical history, that employers were had to be very careful that they weren't actually the ones that were requiring or actually implementing the vaccine at that point, because if they did and they were requesting that individual's medical history, family medical history, that could be an issue with GINA and a direct violation of GINA. So the EEOC was real quick to point that out to employers so they didn't make that mistake. And then that was no longer an issue, because shortly after that, the vaccines did not require that information anymore. And the EEOC addressed these issues and more in its guidance. Specifically, the guidance provided that COVID-19 vaccine mandates do not violate Title VII or the ADA, so long as employers reasonably accommodated their employees with a disability, pregnancy, or sincerely held religious belief. So basically, the EEOC was there to kind of guide employers how to apply the OSHA and CDC guidance while not violating EEO laws. And this also went into the COVID-19 screens that we saw and that were detailed by the CDC guidance. So the EEOC guidance specifically talked about how the pandemic raised novel issues regarding workplace COVID-19 screenings with respect to EEO laws. The EEOC was quick to issue guidance that COVID-19 infection is a direct threat to the workplace, and this directly allowed, or specifically allowed, and paved the way for temperature checks, questions related to COVID-19 symptoms, testing employees for COVID-19 except for the antibody test, asking employees if they have been diagnosed with COVID-19, barring employees who have been diagnosed with COVID-19 or those who refuse to participate in screenings from entering the workplace, and barring those employees with COVID-19 symptoms from the workplace. And that was really important because the EEOC was basically, giving the public employers the go-ahead to say, yes, we know that you're trying to keep your workplace safe. Yes, we know the CDC is guiding you and suggesting, or with OSHA maybe even requiring you to engage in some of these different temperature checks and questions and testing of employees. And we're just making sure that you're going to do it, that you're going to do it and comply with the EEO laws in doing so, and that we're going to basically say that that's okay. And they were just confirming and alleviating employers' fears with respect to them engaging in all these different activities, which helped keep the workplace safe. We have not observed many COVID-19 related EEO lawsuits. This is likely due to the EEOC guidance, which was available within weeks of the pandemic. And we believe that helped reduce any issues employers might have had implementing these safety procedures. And so that was very, very helpful. And so some of the key takeaways from the federal COVID-19 related guidance: employers must remain aware of the guidance and any updates to the guidance. Employers should designate an individual or team tasked with regularly checking for updated guidance. Whenever there's, hopefully we don't have another pandemic soon, but any type of emergency where these novel issues are raised and they have to look towards guidance, and the guidance is updated, constantly, like we saw during the pandemic, the employer should really ensure that there is someone that's designated to regularly check on that guidance. And when in doubt, the good faith rule wins out. So in emergency situations such as the pandemic, federal agencies such as the EEOC expect a good faith compliance with their guidance. And good faith compliance with the EEOC and DOL guidance issued during a national emergency may reduce litigation exposure, even if the guidance later changes. And I think we saw that during the pandemic. And employers should understand that guidance, especially that of non-employment related agencies, may sometimes conflict with employer statutory obligations. And so we recommend that when that happens, the public employers seek advice of labor and employment counsel and their local counsel when those conflicts arise, because they can really help them guide the public employers as to what they need to do, what guidance they need to, consider, and what laws they actually need to make sure that they are still abiding by.
You alluded to public employee vaccine and mask mandates. How did such mandates evolve throughout the pandemic?
So basically what we saw was CDC, OSHA, and the EEOC guidance, as well as the business disturbances caused by COVID-19, they ultimately led to some public employers implementing mask mandates and eventually vaccine mandates when the vaccines became readily available. But such mandates came with pitfalls, and because vaccine mandates may implicate state laws and the Constitution, public employers really should consult with their local labor and employment council in order to navigate the legal implications of such mandates. For instance, what we saw during the pandemic was public employers in states such as Arizona, Florida, Idaho, Kansas, and Texas were strictly prohibited by state law from mandating COVID-19 vaccinations. With respect to mask mandates, although some states, such as Florida, prohibited local governments from implementing population-wide mask mandates, public employers were generally still permitted to implement such mandates among their employees. Of course, that's subject to reasonable accommodations for religious, disability, pregnancy reasons, as well as potentially certain health conditions. However, mask mandates raise other issues unrelated to the COVID-19 pandemic that were kind of novel issues in and of themselves. Because of the times and because of the pandemic. And that was an example of that is employees utilize mask requirements as a form of expression. And we live in an age where some employees now feel emboldened to express political and social speech more than ever at work. As I mentioned earlier, one of the survey results showed that I believe it was 64 or 65% of employees said that they discussed social and political issues at work. And so the presence of masks in public in work environments due to COVID-19 allows for a novel method of expression. Some public employers permit political and social content on masks. Some do not. They have to be very careful, obviously, based on where they are in their state and local laws, as well as their federal laws, including the Constitution. Solicitation issues may also arise with union insignia and masks. So we'll kind of talk about first the First Amendment free speech rights. So types of speech that are never protected are true threats, fighting words, calls to illegal action, obscenity, child pornography, defamation, perjury, plagiarism, solicitation to commit a crime, and blackmail. Despite what they often think, public employees are not free to say whatever they want whenever they want. In determining whether a public employee's speech is entitled to constitutional protection, the Supreme Court has said that the courts must first determine whether the employee spoke as a citizen on a matter of public concern. If the answer is no, the employee has no First Amendment cause of action based on his or her employer's reaction to the speech. In the famous case, Garcetti, the Supreme Court, and that's Garcetti versus Ceballos, the U.S. Supreme Court further explained that when public employees make statements pursuant to their official duties, the employees are not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes, and the Constitution does not insulate their communications from employer discipline. Public sector employees may limit employee speech as a citizen on matters of public concern when there is an adequate justification for treating an employee differently than other citizens. And that really comes from this Rankin versus McPherson Supreme Court case in 1987. And basically what the Supreme Court explained in that case was that the determination whether a public employer has properly discharged an employee for engaging in speech requires a balance between the interests of the employee as a citizen in commenting upon matters of public concern in the interest of the state as an employer in promoting the efficiency of the public services it performs through its employees. So I know here in Florida, there was an issue where a Miami police officer had a pro-Trump face mask that he wore that had explicit language on it, and he wore it to the polls in his police uniform. And obviously that type of behavior, there was a picture taken, and then there was a firestorm about it on social media. It made the news. And that officer was eventually placed on administrative leave, and there was an investigation which occurred. And basically what the courts allow is that when the public employer's efficiency of operations are impacted by an employee's behavior, their speech, that they can limit that speech. And so in that situation, that's a perfect example of when an employee's behavior by wearing a mask that has, inflammatory messages on it, and they're in their police uniform at the polls, on election day, that behavior, that they can limit that type of speech.
Many public employees transitioned to telework during the pandemic. What considerations should public employers take into account when transitioning part of their workforce to telework during future public emergencies and crises?
So the pandemic kind of illustrated public employers need to have teleworking policies in place for emergency situations, such as a public health crisis. Such policies may also be necessary in natural disasters, such as hurricanes, where employees are unable to safely travel to and from the office and may perform certain duties from home. If a policy allows an employee to telework during an emergency without the employee fulfilling all of his or her essential job functions, it's very important that public employers understand that the policy to expressly provide that such exception applies only during the emergency until the employer directs employees to return to the workplace. Such language may assist in insulating a public employer from situations where an employee seeks to continue teleworking as a reasonable accommodation after the employer recalls its employees back to the workplace, because including a return to work provision in a teleworking policy, you know, is essential for employers wishing to return employees to the workplace as soon as the precipitating circumstances subside. And the issue here is that we see is that many employers, including public employers, very quickly had to transition to telework because they had to maintain their operations, but they couldn't do so safely in the workplace. In doing so, a lot of them were basically waiving some of the essential job functions of their employees. And that's very important when employees try to come back after the emergency and they've been returned to work and try to request a reasonable accommodation, teleworking. You know, it's very important for the employer to be clear when that employee was originally placed on teleworking, that they were waiving essential job functions so that the employee cannot later come back and say, well, you know, I request a reasonable accommodation, and because I was teleworking, you know, now clearly that's a reasonable accommodation. That's not the case when essential job functions are waived. So it's really important that employers have in their telework policies, you know, language that they basically says that if they're waiving essential job functions during the emergency, that first they're doing that, and B, that when they're returning the employees back to the workplace, that they are reimposing those essential job functions now that the emergency is over. And so returning to employees to the workplace in a prompt and orderly manner may additionally reduce employee resistance to reinstituting in-person work, and what it also is going to do is once that emergency is over and they no longer need to telework, the quicker that employers put those employees back in the workplace, the stronger argument they have for the reasonable accommodation for any employees to telework that who they waive those essential job functions. And so employers may also boost employee morale by ensuring that the return to work is uniform among all departments. Otherwise, employers may foster interdepartmental animosity amongst employees. So it's really important that that employers have a policy, B, that policy, you know, explains that the employer might be waiving essential job functions, and then C, that once the emergency is over, that employees are quickly transitioned back into their in-office positions or their at-work positions, and then really D, that by doing so, that they're preventing interdepartmental animosity amongst their employees, and they're really ensuring that employees aren't going to take advantage of them having to transition to telework for a period of time by later trying to say, well, that's a reasonable accommodation, but really it might not be because the employer was waiving their essential job functions. And so there's also state law implications. Some states have enacted specific teleworking statutes which public employers must comply with. For instance, prior to the pandemic, Florida enacted a telework statute which applied to certain public employers. Under that law, there was actually a requirement to have a policy in place for teleworking, and there are other states that might have similar state statutes as well. So it's important for public employers to make sure that they know what they have, you know, not only from the federal level, how they can protect themselves by implementing these very well-drafted and, you know, very specific teleworking policies that address certain issues such as temporarily waiving essential job functions, but also that they're complying with their state and local laws that might require certain policies as well and other teleworking requirements. And then teleworking also raised several FLSA pitfalls that public employers need to be aware of. The biggest one was employees working off the clock, working during lunches, answering emails after working hours. That's why it's so important that in these teleworking policies that employers clearly set out the expectations of when employees are supposed to be working and when they're not, and recording their hours. And it's also important that employers enforce those policies, because if a public employer knows an employee is answering emails, you know, after hours, a non-exempt, you know, employee is answering emails after hours, then they're going to have an issue if suddenly this employee comes back and says, hey, well, you know, I worked all these extra hours and I didn't get paid, so you need to, you know, you now need to pay and compensate me for these hours. The employer can't say, well, we didn't know that you weren't working or anything like that, because they didn't know, because they were receiving emails from this employee after working hours and they didn't discipline the employee, they didn't enforce their policy, and now they're in a situation where they might have an FLSA violation. So it's very important for those types of issues to be addressed in the teleworking policies. And also another issue that public employers sometimes overlook is that compensating for employees for certain work-related items needed to work from home, those issues should be addressed in the policy as well. Because if costs to work from home are bringing employees below minimum wage or overtime compensation due in any work week, that could be an FLSA issue. And also certain states, such as Florida, for certain public employers have statutes which require the public employer to provide teleworking employees with equipment and supplies necessary to carry out job functions. So they really need to include, public employers really need to include these issues as well for if they're going to have a teleworking policy, if they're going to have employees telework, then they need to basically address, you know, how the employee is going to get the equipment that they need to telework from home. And that should all be in the policy as well. Teleworking also has raised workers' compensation concerns. Workers' compensation varies from state to state. An interesting Florida example is an employee working from home tripped over her dog and fell while getting coffee in her kitchen. The fall resulted in injuries to the employee's knees, knee, hip, and shoulder. And this was interesting because ultimately what the courts held was that the risk of tripping over a dog while getting coffee was not introduced by the employee's employment. The court noted that the employee could have just as easily tripped over her dog while reaching for coffee during non-working hours on a Saturday, and that the risk existed as long as the dog remained in the employee's house. So I know public employers around the country might start to see some of these liability issues, and so these are kind of one of the big novel issues that we're expecting to see more of as well as teleworking progresses. Some employers which initially embraced telework during the pandemic and considered implementing some degree of permanent teleworking arrangements for employees are now shifting back to full-time in-office attendance. I know that's both in the private and public sector that's occurring. And so we just kind of reiterate that, you know, employers need to be very careful when they're allowing employees to telework past emergent circumstances, that they're not creating any potential future issues with suddenly allowing a situation where an employee can now claim that teleworking is a reasonable accommodation if the employer wishes for employees to be back in the office.
What were some of the state and local law challenges experienced by public employers during the pandemic, and how did public employers successfully navigate such challenges?
So that's a good question, because the pandemic experience for public employers really varied by state. You know, some states were very strict about mask mandates and vaccine mandates, and those were imposed by public employers either voluntarily or by, you know, state or local law. And then other states such as Florida, you know, we saw where public employers were eventually prohibited from instituting vaccine mandates. And so there was this really interesting dynamic between an interplay between state and local laws and, you know, from state to state, and how those interacted with public employers enacting safety measures in their workplace. And so if we look at the Florida perspective, Florida enacted a SB 2006 in May of 2021, which basically codified and expanded upon Governor DeSantis's Executive Order 21-81, and the law prohibited a governmental entity from requiring a person to provide any documentation certifying COVID-19 vaccination or post-infection recovery in order to gain access to, entry upon, or services from the governmental entity's operations. So basically what that said was you can't ask a person to provide you with a COVID-19 vaccine, you know, proof of COVID-19 vaccination or post-infection recovery for them to enter the premises. Now, this was a very broad statute, and this was right around the time when many employers, public employers in Florida, were considering imposing vaccine mandates. So because the statute was kind of ambiguous and it was only restricting the request for documentation certifying COVID-19 vaccination, there was an argument that, well, we're not going to request, you know, certifying documentation of a vaccination, but we'll just impose a vaccine mandate. And then if we find out through, you know, an employee basically telling everyone that they're not vaccinated or something like that, then we'll take steps to enforce our policy. And that was kind of the argument was that would be a workaround of, you know, requiring documentation certifying COVID-19 vaccination for a vaccine mandate. So quickly, the attorney general in a case, in a pretty big case for a local city, basically argued that the law prohibited vaccine mandates outright, which was kind of a thought of where that was going anyways. And sure enough, you know, SB 2006, it subsequently was kind of clarified by House Bill 1B. And House Bill 1B on November 18th, 2021, Governor DeSantis signed this bill into law, and it became effective immediately. And basically what House Bill 1B did was among other things, it prohibited public employers from implementing and enforcing employee COVID-19 vaccine mandates. So that was just an example of how the state and local laws kind of interplayed, you know, with public employers' abilities to keep their, you know, basically implement policies, safety policies during the pandemic. That's just kind of the Florida example, because the HB1B basically came in and said, okay, you know what, there's ambiguity in this in the SB 2006 law. We're just going to make it perfectly clear that, you know, public employers are not going to be able to implement COVID-19 vaccine mandates. And that's what we saw with here in Florida. You know, it could have been the opposite in states where, such as, you know, California, where there were, you know, vaccine mandates and, you know, certain requirements. In certain other states where there might have been requirements, they would have had kind of the opposite interaction with the state and local laws. So really the challenges of the state and local laws that public employers experienced was just basically trying to make sure that they were following the right guidance and the right laws, because they had the CDC and OSHA and the EEOC saying that they could vaccinate, but then they had to be very careful that they're still paying attention to state and local laws, because, you know, while the CDC and OSHA and the EEOC were just providing guidance, you know, they really had to comply with the actual law. And for example, in Florida, the law was you can't implement a vaccine mandate. And so public employers had to make sure that they were following those laws.
In conclusion, how can public employers prepare for the next pandemic?
So the biggest obstacle faced by most public employers was their lack of preparation for the level of disruption which the pandemic caused. Accordingly, preparation is really key, and public employers have learned to expect the unexpected. Right now is really the time for public employers to review all of their policies and revise policies which employees or management found ambiguous or difficult to apply in a prolonged emergency situation. You know, now that the pandemic is we're coming towards the tail end, now it's the time for them to public employers to reflect and improve on their policies. And for public employers with a unionized workforce, it's important for them to address extended emergencies in their CBAs. They need to ensure that the process of implementing emergency measures is streamlined. So if they need to, you know, negotiate those management rights clauses to give them more leeway to implement safety, you know, safety checks and things of those nature in another pandemic, or, you know, any other type of just any type of issues that they might need to address in any type of emergency situation where, you know, whether it's a natural disaster or pandemic, that they really need to somehow put a mechanism in their CBA for them to be able to make those kind of on-the-fly decisions and directions of their employees in those situations. And I cannot emphasize enough the importance of preparing and maintaining detailed emergency procedures, policies, and planning for the next prolonged crisis. Public employers may wish to focus on teleworking, you know, furloughs, layoffs, work schedules, compensation, benefits, and workplace safety. You know, those are all issues that we saw employers kind of struggling with and trying to basically kind of deal with on the fly. And so it's important to now reflect on what happened during the pandemic, how it affected the, you know, public employers individually, and basically how they can best implement these policies and plannings and procedures that will basically streamline their ability to perform the services that they perform, and just streamline managing their employees, you know, should we ever end up in another pandemic or even just a natural disaster or prolonged emergent situation. And the public employers wishing to keep emergency preparedness policies and procedures separate from their current employment policies, they may even choose to create and maintain a separate handbook, you know, a disaster/emergency employee handbook for pandemic level disruptions. And then kind of concluding today's podcast, the pandemic brought forth many novel issues which require public employers to remain vigilant as to ongoing developments. Good faith application of agency guidance may offer some risk protection, but remaining current on such guidance and the law is really key. And that's what we really learned from this whole experience, was that, you know, things were changing daily, especially at the early onset of the pandemic. The guidance, the laws, the executive orders, everything was changing literally daily and weekly. And so it was just vital that public employers stayed up to date on that guidance to make sure that they were mitigating their risks as much as possible. The pandemic also reminded public employers that they must always consider employees' constitutional rights when unilaterally implementing employee mandates and developing the limitations on such mandates. For instance, free speech issues are increasingly common with mask mandates and just wearing masks in general, and should not be taken lightly. And then just be prepared, you know, prepare. It's so important that employers take a step back now, public employers take a step back now and reflect on what they can do to streamline their processes in the next pandemic. And really, when in doubt, it's important that they consult their local labor and employment law practitioners, because our job is to stay on top of this stuff. And, you know, this was we lived and breathed, you know, the daily changes and guidance and executive orders and laws on both the local and state level throughout the whole process. And so employers should really, you know, take advantage of seeking guidance from advice from local counsel, from their local labor and employment law practitioners, in order to help prepare themselves for these types of situations in the future.
We've reached the end of our podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Please visit the Prima website to hear other Prima podcasts, view upcoming Prima webinars, read Prima blogs, and learn about other Prima educational resources. Be sure to check us out on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and our very own Prima Talk. Have an amazing day.